Subcommittee on Revenue is open. Good evening, everyone. Tonight, we are going to continue with some presentations we've been having over the last week or so. We had one from OBI last week during the fake snowstorm just before. Tonight, we've invited, they've accepted the Coalition for Common Good, which has been working on various aspects of the business plan. Next week, I believe, we will have a Revenue Coalition, Revenue Roundtable, present some ideas. In the meantime, we have our legislative revenue analysts crunching numbers and doing things. So there's work going on, and I'm hoping that next week or the week after, we can start to turn the corner and put some bones to this masterpiece here. Mixing metaphors as I go. So let's bring up the Common Good Coalition for your presentation. After your presentation, Chris Allenek is going to walk us through some sort of hypothetical business scenarios under various tax schemes. So welcome, all of you.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Carlson. I'm the CEO of the Oregon Healthcare Association. We're a statewide trade association that represents about 1,000 businesses and organizations across the state, and our members employ about 50,000 Oregonians. I'm also representing today the Coalition for the Common Good. And our coalition is a unique group of Oregon labor organizations and businesses committed to helping build and support solutions to help achieve our aspirations as a state and to help address significant challenges that we face. You've got a slide deck here, and our testimony is not going to follow exactly the slide deck, but we are going to be making reference to some of the materials in it as we go along this evening. We are united in our belief that the status quo in Oregon is untenable. Despite the best of intentions, past attempts to solve some of our most pressing problems have not brought about the solutions we all desire. I think we're all united in our belief that revenue reform and adequately funding schools are two of the most significant challenges we face today. For over the last 50 years, every Oregon governor since Tom McCall has grappled with the problem created by our current tax structure. Both Republican governors, Democratic governors, Republican legislatures, Democratic legislatures have struggled in their efforts to fail to address the inadequacies of our current system. Our goal as a coalition is not to recommend to your committee tonight any one single proposal, but to instead offer to work with you and other businesses and organizations to develop pragmatic, nonpartisan solutions from a menu of options that you have before the committee. We stand ready to work with you and the legislature as a whole on proposals that reflect our collective values and that will raise an additional $2 billion a biennium in targeted additional investments to fund our schools. It is our hope that we will arrive at a common destination with your committee and that the work you come up with, and that we will be able to help rally broad-based support for your work from business leaders and labor organizations, and most importantly, from Oregonians across the state. Before shifting gears into a very brief and high-level summary of the menu of various revenue proposals we've been focused on, I wanted to take just a minute to discuss our current tax structure and let you know that there's one thing our coalition is unanimous on, and that is our belief that the status quo, our current tax structure in Oregon, is not a tax system worth defending. This is not a hill to die on, is a clear message that we have. And we don't believe if anyone was to go back and design a tax system from scratch today in any state in this country, that they would come up with a system like we have today in Oregon. First off, it is not delivering the resources that we need to fund the level of investments desired in education and other essential services for our state. We are more reliant than any other state in the country is on revenue from personal income taxes, high personal income taxes. Our disproportionate reliance on personal income taxes results in volatility and instability during downswings in the economy. And Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Haas, I did include the infamous Swiss Alps slide in the slide deck tonight, just in your honor. The high personal income tax rates we pay in Oregon results in a tax system whereby a minimum wage worker hits the 9% tax rate after only $8,700 in earnings. And I don't think that's something any of us should be proud of. Less than a third of the way through the year, a minimum wage worker hits a 9% tax rate in our state. We believe that diversifying and broadening our business or commercial tax base would also give us the opportunity to provide some tax relief to individual taxpayers in Oregon, particularly at the low and middle income levels. And we think that's a very important objective as we work with you. Most of the coalition's work to date has focused on six different options. And I believe there is a slide there that kind of goes through some different options. Basically, we've been spending time looking at a simple commercial activities tax, a CAT, if you will, with a low rate, a broad base, and very few exemptions, close to the Ohio model. We've been looking at a simple CAT with additional exemptions for certain essentials, for example, groceries, fuel, utilities, and some health care. We've been looking at tiered CAT to reflect different industry needs and impacts with very few exemptions. A tiered CAT with additional exemptions for those essentials I outlined a moment ago. We've been looking at a Washington State B&O type tax, and we've been looking at the business activity tax or VAT, such as was outlined by OBI in your hearing last week. We have been following both the work and the discussions in your committee, as well as engaging in a lot of discussions with tax policy experts and a wide variety of different types of Oregon businesses and organizations. Like any tax, there are certainly pros and cons. And I think if I'm gonna just briefly touch on, if you look at a BAT or VAT, we certainly appreciate OBI bringing this option to the table, and we certainly appreciate their acknowledgement of the need for revenue reform in the state. I think that was very important, and their welcome voice in this discussion. I think a BAT or a VAT is an intriguing option. We don't have a lot of experience in it in other states, but we find an intriguing option. I think in its purest form, a VAT is an origin-based tax. However, as I understand the proposal from OBI, they're proposing to make it a destination-based tax through the apportionment formula. And I think that while this can work well for larger companies that apportion sales across multiple states, one thing we're going to want to look at as we explore a VAT proposal is how does that work for a smaller business who sell out of state but cannot apportion because they lack nexus with other states? And that's something I think Mr. Alanek and your team can drill down on a little bit more. But that's one of the things that, you know, has come up in some of the discussions we've had about that is how it impacts that small business who cannot apportion. On a CAT, I think the advantage there would be that it's broad-based and a relatively low rate. I know that many Oregon businesses we have spoken with have experience with it in other states out in the West, in Washington and Nevada, in the Midwest with Ohio. Back to the BAT or the VAT, we haven't had a chance to really talk with many Oregon businesses who do work in New Hampshire, which is the only state currently using a form of that tax. I think the main criticism that we hear of a CAT is the potential for pyramiding effect in certain sectors with multiple in-state transactions. And so I just want to really identify that I think something that mitigates that to some extent here in Oregon is the fact that we are one of only a handful of states without a sales tax. Pyramiding is also a factor in states that have sales taxes. Studies show that 40% of sales tax revenue in states with sales taxes come from business-to-business transactions. The lack of sales of a sales tax here in Oregon on most B2B transactions is one of the reasons why Oregon's overall business tax rate comes in comparatively low on those national comparisons. While a retail sales tax applies to a smaller economic base generally than a commercial activity tax would, retail sales taxes can also have a pyramiding effect, and they do so at a much higher tax rate, generally speaking, than a CAT. For example, a single transaction at the Washington State sales tax rate of 6.5% could equal up to a dozen different transactions of a 0.5 CAT for example. And so I think when we're doing that competitive analysis with neighboring states, and you do hear criticisms about a cat, about pyramiding, I think we also need to understand that other states in the Western United States all have sales taxes. If I'm looking at Idaho with 6%, if I'm looking at Washington, 6.5%, and I think that's a mitigating factor that we need to take into consideration. The challenge before your committee and this legislature is significant and important. Let's face it, restructuring our tax system has been a bit of a holy grail in the state for about 50 plus years now. And I think I want to leave you with these final thoughts and questions before turning it over to my colleague, Mr. Russell. The first one is the status quo delivering the results and the outcomes we desire? And I think that's a really important question because it's really easy to shoot at something new and something that's proposed. But I think we need to juxtapose that against the status quo. And is the status quo getting the job done? And is it a good tax system? If not now, when? There will always be competing issues and priorities for the state. There are now, there have been in the past, there will be in the future. And my final question is, what is the cost of continued inaction? Do we really want to risk shortchanging another generation of Oregon school children due to continued inaction, waiting for some perfect solution or some perfect time? So we want to thank you for your attention to this very important issue, and we stand ready to work with you. John?
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is John Russell. I'm the founder and president of Russell Development Company in Portland. We helped to shape the skyline of the city we know and love today. We developed, we're an owner of PacWest Center, developed in the mid-80s, and have owned the 200 Market building for some 30 years. I chose to live in Oregon because I had the sense early on that Oregonians could control their own destiny. I'm testifying today as a member of the Coalition for Common Good because I believe that Oregon schools need roughly $2 billion of additional investments in order to jumpstart both the short-term and the long-term economies. Spreadsheets can't quantify the impact of investments in education, but that doesn't diminish their impact and importance. Status quo in our schools today is both unacceptable and untenable. We all know that. In the short term, businesses rely on public schools that attract people to Oregon so that we can hire well-educated, talented employees. In the long term, educating our children is vitally important. We know that. I mean, that's not a secret. Businesses rely on Oregon's quality of life, including highly performing public schools, to attract highly skilled workers from around the world. When businesses are asked what the biggest factor is in where they decide to locate, strong public schools and universities are at the top of the list. If our goal is to create a vibrant, growing economy in Oregon and the high-paying jobs and economic opportunity that comes with those, we must begin with a fully funded educational system that's something we can be proud of. Excuse me. We can achieve a strong public education system and a state where businesses can grow and thrive. However, despite best intentions, past attempts to solve Oregon's revenue system have not resulted in solutions. I want to address the issue of coupling PERS with this revenue conversation. I'm a member of the Oregon Investment Council, and I understand well the PERS issue and its impact. However, I've also watched state and legislative leadership grapple with the question of revenue year after year with the same result, inaction. If businesses wanted to insist on maintaining the status quo, the proven technique is to link revenue to something else. For Oregon to finally be successful in passing revenue reform, it's my belief that we must keep the revenue conversation separate from the question of PERS. The Coalition for the Common Good is taking an unconventional approach, bringing labor and businesses together. I stand ready alongside partners at the Coalition for the Common Good to work with the legislature and this committee to review, inform, and support proposals that reflect collective values, will raise at least $2 billion to fund our public schools, can gain support among Oregon's advocates and business leaders and are a political viable option to both the legislature and Oregonians. In closing, we can foresee class sizes shrink so that the students are getting individual attention they need. We can see teachers' aides in classrooms. We can add art, music, and PE to the average school day. We can add school counselors and supports and more time in the school year. Bold investments in education will move Oregon forward in ways that can't always be quantified on a spreadsheet or in a tax model, but they will help create a vibrant, growing economy that we want for our state. But we have to step forward and control our own destiny. We believe that the time is now for bold, visionary leadership on revenue reform. Thank you.
Co-Chair Haas and Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, thanks for letting me testify tonight. While I testify, could we go back to the PowerPoint that we started off with? I'm just going to pull up a couple of those the slide deck. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the executive director of SEIU Local 503. As many of you know, our union represents over 65,000 public and care workers throughout the state of Oregon, and we're excited to be a part of the Coalition for the Common Good. The strength of our coalition is really bringing together different perspectives. And as you can see, what you won't hear tonight is one proposal that fits our criteria. What you'll see is that we have a set of shared values, and we'll walk through some of our criteria that we believe different proposals can meet as we look at them. And so we're really excited to really talk with you. And I think Jim did a great job of laying that out of the different kinds of proposals. And we bring to this a set of values that we're evaluating all of those proposals by and a set of criteria. We've been, as I think many of you know, we've been involved in nearly every campaign and effort to adequately fund services for the last 30 years, and we're excited to be a part of this renewed effort and a part of this new coalition. When Measure 5 passed nearly 30 years ago now, voters were delivering a message that the cost of property taxes was causing too much strain on family budgets. The impact was a reduction in property taxes, but also a shift in funding for schools to the state budget that has had long-term consequences for all of the services in our state. The impact of Measure 5 was not just on education or on property taxes, because in the following years, Oregon was the only state to propose an actual decrease in funding to higher education, and tuition skyrocketed. Seniors saw cutbacks in services. We became heavily reliant on the use of fees to fund our natural resource agencies and other budgets, and we still see the impacts on child welfare and other human services with understaffing and a lack of updated technology. If Measure 5 had not passed nearly 30 years ago, we would have over $2 billion more in revenue every year and about $4.2 billion a biennium. So here we are today. And a lot has happened in the last 29 years, many different coalitions, many different ideas, and many different ballot measures. We have the opportunity to take a significant step forward this year to fund education by coming together with businesses, advocates, legislators, and voters. Our organization, SEIU 503, does not think $2 billion will solve the systematic underfunding of services that we face in Oregon. As I noted, the impacts of underfunding during good economic times and the cuts, the severe cuts during recessions have left lasting impacts on our agencies, which can be seen through the Secretary of State audits on child welfare or aging and people with disabilities, and the high tuition and the increasing numbers of out-of-state students at some of our public universities. But to move forward on those issues, we must first fund education. It's Oregonians and our members' priority to fund an education system where all kids, black, brown, and white, can have equal opportunity to succeed and get the support they need. And $2 billion that is dedicated and tied to outcomes such as lower class sizes will go a long way in making significant investments in funding that system. It will not fund all the services that need to be funded in our state, but we believe it's a critical step to stabilize our budget. As noted in our slide deck, Oregon continues to rank very low, there it is, in our corporate tax rate, which is why we believe the solution needs to be through modifications to our business tax structure. As a coalition for the common good, we are working towards $2 billion in revenue. I'm gonna come to this slide. $2 billion in revenue that is funded through a business tax that has been tested and used in other states, that can win the support of some business and business leaders that want to step up and fund education, can win the support of advocates who have been fighting to fund services for decades. can win the support of the legislature and can win the support of Oregonians. We know that we can't succeed without all of these constituencies coming together to find a solution. We also belong to another group of advocates, as we have for the last 30 years. This group is being led by Our Oregon, the Coalition of the Communities of Color, the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and Fair Shot, that are continuing to work towards a long-term solution to underfunding services as well. We have many of the same principles that we do as a part of the Coalition for the Common Good. In addition, that we want to make sure that the revenue solution is progressive and does not further tax working Oregonians, since they pay over 70% of the current tax revenue of the state. And that we look at the revenue solutions and subsequent funding through an equity lens, so we understand the racial and gender impacts of the policy. We are engaging with our partners at this table and many others about how the different proposals you all are looking at and we are looking at meet those requirements. And we believe that many of the different proposals have the ability to meet these standards. I also want to end by recognizing the testimony from OBC last week that was specifically tied to one proposal, but also tying that revenue to the PERS reform. There's been a PERS conversation started in the Capital Construction Committee. And as John Russell indicated, we don't really believe these two things should be tied together. But I also want to add, I added two editorials into the record, one from 2003 and one from 2013, both calling on the revenue, the legislature, and businesses to step up and dig into revenue reform after the legislature tackled PERS in both of those sessions. OBC is just running a campaign that has worked for them before. By tying PERS to revenue, they have successfully had three different changes to the PERS system since 1990, creating two different systems and another significant change in 2013, but there has yet to be a substantive discussion about how we fund essential services. In the 2013 editorial, it notes that it was hard to get to revenue because so much time was spent on PERS. I know that the PERS conversation will continue, but it is time to finally take the next steps on funding education and services. We are looking forward to working with you to figure out exactly what model will work for Oregonians and Oregon businesses. Oregonians and our members can't afford the cost of inaction. Thank you for taking the time for our testimony, and I look forward to any questions.
Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Trent Lutz. I'm the Assistant Executive Director for Public Affairs for the Oregon Education Association. The Oregon Education Association represents 45,000 educators across the state, or over 45,000, actually representing over 600,000 Oregon students. Our members are everything from counselors, teachers, school bus drivers, to our community college members. The reason that I'm here testifying today and that we've become part of the Coalition for the Common Good is that we know that currently our education system is in crisis. You have seen that as you have traveled the state and spent hundreds of hours making sure that you're hearing from members from around the state, from educators, from parents, from business leaders, knowing that there's issues. There's been decades of disinvestment in education that's resulted in unacceptable learning conditions. Oregon students have some of the largest class sizes. We have low graduation rates. We have one of the lowest, one of the shortest school years in the entire nation. We have caseloads that are completely unacceptable, that are completely outside of national recommendations. Funding for career technical education, arts, music, physical education have slowly been decreased, and those programs have further been cut. Over the past 3 years, we've been sharing more and more stories about the extreme behavior that's been happening in Oregon schools. Students' needs are being unmet. Educators cannot provide safe, welcoming, and inclusive environments for all of the students that they have. We call this disrupted learning, and it's something that continues to grow and build. It's the large class sizes, it's the teachers stretched so thin without the psychologist, instructional assistants, that unfortunately has led to students falling through the cracks. We know that there is a better way to serve our students, and what we need is that we actually need more services and we need more revenue to make that happen. We must increase on-site supports, reduce class sizes and caseloads, fully fund high-quality professional development. We know that none of these are easy fixes, and they'll all require funding to systematic changes to education, but they're critically important to address these issues. Ultimately, it's our students that are paying the price for this disinvestment. That is why I think earlier this week you might have seen it. We had close to 5,000 members, parents, and students out rallying and marching here at the Capitol. They were out demanding that we address the issues facing Oregon students and increase funding. This is something that many Oregonians believe that we need. because we believe it's time that Oregonians come together with new approaches to solve the entrenched systematic issues that are the root of the issue. These changes enacted must also move us away from the inequities that really have a disproportionate impact on students of color, students with disability, and historically underserved students. Now, we applaud the hard work of this committee and their bold action to address revenue, to address the needs to fully fund our schools and starting to deal with the three decades of disinvestment. We believe that the revenue package really has to have accomplish two things, which is number one, it must raise billions with an S of dollars. That this committee itself, after hearing and compiling all the different programs, came up with a list of recommendations that equaled well over $3 billion in what would need to be funded to fund schools. Secondly, is that the funds raised for a new revenue package must be tied to specific investments in education that we know that our communities desperately need. Those dollars need to go directly into the Oregon classrooms, that they have an immediate and positive impact on reducing class size, adding supports and services, and restoring programs that have been cut. The Oregon Education Association is a member of this coalition, the Coalition of Common Good, because past attempts to solve the Oregon's most pressing problems have not brought forth adequate solutions. For decades, our schools and essential public services have continued to lack adequate investments. The status quo is both unacceptable and untenable. We believe the legislature is the right place for this inclusive, robust, critical conversation, and we're eager to work in partnership with this committee and leaders from across the state and other partners of the coalition for the common good to make meaningful investments in Oregon's future. Thank you for your time, and I think we're open to asking or answering questions.
Moving forward with these, with this approach, you're leaving us with the hard part, and that's inserting rates into some of these funds.
We're right behind you.
Yeah.
That is really
where the rubber hits the road, and we're going to hopefully turn that corner and have some bones on some of these plans in the next week or two. Any questions of the Coalition for a Common Good?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick?
I just wanted to kind of elaborate on the statement that Melissa made about the impact of Measure 5. As we consider the imbalance between corporate taxes and individual taxes in Oregon, that actually started with Measure 5, because Measure 5 had a little fine print in it which said all properties had to be fully assessed. On a regular basis, I think it was every 6 months. And the practice before Measure 5 was to fully assess businesses along the way. The assessors statewide assess businesses fully, whereas residential properties were underassessed pretty severely in Portland, and I'm sure in other communities as well. So when Measure 5 went into effect, and again, the business community overall opposed Measure 5. They did not do this by design, but the effect of Measure 5 was to give massive tax relief to businesses and minimal tax relief to residential, which led to Measure 49 and 50 later, when the homeowners didn't get the tax relief that they were promised, but the businesses got huge tax relief. And again, they by and large did not ask for it, but they got it from Measure 5. And that's a big source of the imbalance that we find ourselves in now.
So, Rep. Nathanson.
Thank you for being here for the presentation. There's a lot of good information on the slides and in your testimony. I appreciate your providing the testimony in writing as well, so I can go back and reread the words. Could we look at slide 13 again, please?
Which one is that one?
That one's a beautiful one.
It's on slide 13.
Measure 5 equals $4 billion school funding gap. There's some pretty remarkable information on this slide, and it follows in on what Senator Burdick was just mentioning. Point three, if revenues stayed at the same proportion of income, it means a difference of $4.2 billion for the biennium. So that's translating to today's dollars. that's a really important thing to note. If we had been able to stay on the same track, how many more of Oregon's students would have been able to enjoy a longer school year, would have had the opportunity to participate in music and art and enjoy school libraries, have school counselors available? How many students wouldn't have dropped out in the last 10 years? When I think what could have been, it makes me even more energized to think about what we need to do now. Because look at what we lost over that time period and how much we have, how far we have to go to make up for that lost opportunity. So that slide was really important. I hadn't seen this analysis before on a piece of paper in written testimony. So I'm glad you raised it.
If I may, one of the lost opportunities, and it is impossible to quantify it, are the businesses that chose not to locate in Oregon because of the reputation for inadequate public schools. I mean, I think Doonesbury, we were ridiculed there. So that, you don't know the business that didn't come here, but it certainly had an impact on our economy.
A brief follow-up. I had a meeting with a couple of people involved in business, high-tech related business, a couple of years ago, and they were telling me about the challenge of being able to attract talent because they were having to play catch-up and basically defense, because as they were recruiting, people were looking into school districts and course offerings and what's it going to be like for their third grader or their eighth grader. And in the area that I represent, which is Eugene, they were really scrambling to find examples of, here's some good things the kids can have access to.
Yeah.
So I understand it's been a challenge to attract the interest of CEOs who choose to locate or invest and expand. And it's also been a challenge to just attract talent for businesses to be able to grow, the ones that are already here. So I'm acknowledging the comment that you just made. I'm remembering now conversations I've had with people in my own district about this.
I wish it was possible to quantify the effect on the economy, but it's not possible. These are missed opportunities.
If I might, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, I just saw a survey of CEOs that was published recently where they ranked their number one priority as talent acquisition in the workforce. Mm-hmm. And so getting a well-educated, well-trained workforce, there is nothing more important to businesses in the current economy today.
Senator Benz.
I just had one question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at the at that same slide and trying to figure out what impact had we had those increased taxes it would have had on the preceding chart. I was trying to figure out what that percentage increase in property taxes would have done on the state taxes by source. And notice it's the blue column, isn't it? Would it put us up to the U.S. average? Would it put us past it? I'm just curious.
Harrison, Senator Benz, I think one thing to note is this is state taxes by source. So the property taxes don't count into our state taxes because we don't have any statewide property taxes. So it wouldn't relate to this this graph specifically. But I think going back to your question, I do think we could come back with some analysis about like what would property taxes be like in the local economies. I think it's important. I mean, I think it's important to note that ballot measures passed because people are trying to solve a problem. They're a blunt instrument, and that was a blunt instrument to solve a property tax, what people perceive to be a property tax crisis, but didn't have the long-term impacts of the funding crisis that would go along with it. That's not how people made that decision, and I think that's an important note when you look back at those ballot measures from the 1990s.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Follow up. Right. Thank you for that. I guess what I'm saying is it would be nice to see what impact.
Yep.
the increases discussed in that slide would have on the preceding slide. Someone might want to run those numbers so I could see it. Mm-hmm. That would be helpful.
I think, yes, Rep. Smith.
I'm going to regret this.
most likely.
Yeah, I know. There's times where you're like, just don't say it.
When in doubt, keep it inside.
All right, I got to ask this. I really appreciate the work that's coming forward. Really appreciate it. All of you here, we've had long relationships. Appreciate it. But there is an element of Oregon's population that would say, we can put more money into education if we prioritize our spending. What would you say to them?
I'd say, co-chairs, Representative Smith, I won't for one second pretend that other issues that are being dealt with and need to be addressed in this building and challenges we face at a state should get short shrift. So be it cost containment or dealing with unfunded liability that we've got looming out there, all of these are great challenges. My compadre, Mr. Russell, remarked to me the other day, we ought to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. And we're in the revenue subcommittee here. And I think part of what our message to you all is that linkage or some quest for a perfect solution or some grand bargain has been a very elusive thing to capture. I hear of unicorns. I've never seen a unicorn. And I'm not saying it can't be done on some grand, elegant, grand bargain, but how many more years are we going to keep chasing it until we step up to the plate? Part of what I think we're saying is we don't have a tax system today anybody should be proud of. Nobody else in the country has a tax system like we have today. We are disproportionately reliant on high personal income taxes, and we have very little, if any, diversification on that. And if we had an opportunity to put more diversification in our tax structure and to provide property tax or personal income tax relief to Oregonians, I think a lot of Oregon taxpayers would be very interested in seeing what that looks like. And I, for one, don't think we should be afraid to call the question with Oregon voters and ask them what they think.
Thank you. I guess I didn't regret my question. Thank you.
Well, just to elaborate on it, if I may. So I'm a member of the Oregon Investment Council. I'm painfully aware of the unfunded liability. But I'm also aware of the past inactions of prior legislatures to deal with revenue. And in my own view, linking revenue to something else is like waiting for the second coming of Christ.
Well, I appreciate your reference to ballot measure 5. It happened a long time ago. I was a young news guy when that happened. But I do remember, you know, voters were angry. The property taxes were out of whack. They were out of balance. And we had stories of seniors in Multnomah County being taxed out of the homes if that was going to continue. And that's why voters passed that, and to bring things into balance. The problem was it was never offset. Correct. Down the road after that, and schools have been taking the brunt of that. My hope here for this panel is that we do find and try to restore some of that balance. My goal here, and this will be a disappointment to some people, is not to raise every dollar we can get our hands on and bring through the door, but to achieve some of that balance and improve our existing revenue policy where we can. And we can do that through the legislature. We don't need an initiative measure to do that. So I very much appreciate your coming forward and with your analysis. I hope you'll keep the lines of communication open with us, with OBI, as we start doing the hard part, which is installing some rates and who's in, who's out, and those kinds of hard decisions. And those are going to be hard, and those are going to, things are going to get heated. And so thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
We have asked our legislative revenue officer to hypothetical businesses and under what scenarios of a commercial activity tax or VAT tax, and how much they would pay, how much they would pay more or less. So I will turn this over to you, Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so this is going from a very high level discussion to straight into the weeds. Some examples, and this may look familiar to some folks who were following the discussion in 2017. This is kind of a recycled table from 2017. And I didn't really change any of the language. I think I changed the rate. The discussion was a little bit different last time. So a commercial business activities tax of 0.48% for sales above $1 million, and there's a flat $250 for sales less than that. So any business that had sales of less than $1 million, the tax was a flat $250. And then for any amount of sales above $1 million, it was taxed at a rate of 0.48%. So the top part of the chart are four examples. So we have an S corporation, and it helps some folks for me to put some kind of name of a business on there. And they're kind of picked at random. This S corporation is a lumber producer. So their total sales are $310 million. 20 million of those sales are in Oregon, and 290 million of those sales are exported. So this tax structure of 250 plus 0.48% of sales would result in a tax, a CAT or BAT, of about $91,000. So the units are here in millions, and I've tried to, for the tax amount.
Thank you. That's an economist's way of writing. And for the rest of us, thanks.
It was either that or have different units on the.
I understand. That would have been an unnatural act for you.
So. Okay, the second item, an LLC. A farmer has $410 million in sales, $5 million in Oregon, and $405 million are exported. So that is a tax of about $19,000. And the third category is sole proprietor, a graphics designer. Total sales of $2.2 million. Most of that is in Oregon, $2 million. And just about $200,000 exported. And their tax is about $5,000. So this is just that simple kind of receipts tax with the language of commercial or business activities. Then the fourth category here is a C corporation, and this is a manufacturer. And at the time last session, there was a part of the discussion was whether or not the company had nexus with Oregon or not. And mm-hmm. So in this particular case, the manufacturer does not have nexus. So that means the implication being they wouldn't be subject to the income tax. So their total sales was $600 million, and they sold $150 million into Oregon, and elsewhere about $450 million. Their liability for this kind of tax, if it were instituted, would be about $715,000. So this is the example of, I think sometimes the language is the flyovers.
Yeah. So these are companies that are not paying in Oregon now, but are selling Correct. Their products into Oregon, and now would be assess this tax.
Correct. And it gets into the fact that they don't have nexus.
Okay. Any questions on that so far?
Okay, the bottom part of the table is a little trickier to follow. It tries to get at one aspect of potential pyramiding. And so I have this tree to table example. So going line by line, starting off at the first column there, production level, we start with the cutting. So I just set and this is obviously very simplified. So no inputs, but the value added is $5 million. And so they have $5 million in sales. $1 million is in Oregon, and $4 million is exported. So they're right at that $1 million mark, so they would pay the minimum tax, $250. And so if you note that $1 million in Oregon sales translates into the second column on the second row for processing. The inputs for the processing is the $1 million. So the cutter making the $1 million in sales in Oregon go to the processing company, and that's their inputs, the $1 million. They add value of $5 million so that their total sales are $6 million. And in Oregon, they sell $1.5 million, and they export 4.5 million. So their cat or bat tax on the 1.5 million is just about $3,000. And then if we go down to the lumber wholesaler, we see their inputs are 1.503 million, and that is the sum of the 1.5 million from the processing sales in Oregon, mm-hmm. plus the cat or bat of $3,000. So this assumes, well, there are all kinds of assumptions in here, but this is a full forwarding of the pyramid. And so they add value of 2 million, and they have total sales of 3.504 million. 0.904 million is in Oregon, and the remainder is exported. So they're under $1 million, so they pay the minimum tax. And their 0.904 million of Oregon sales goes to the furniture manufacturer, and that's their input amount. They add value of 10.1 million, so their total sales are 11.004 million. Of that, 3.004 million is sold in Oregon, and 8 million is exported. And so they're paying about $10,000 in the cat or bat. And then finally, that 3.004 million in Oregon sales goes to the retailer who sells, that's their inputs. They add value of a million. This is the notion of a low margin business. So their total sales are 4.019 million. 2.519 million is in Oregon, and then 1.5 is exported. So their cat and bat tax is about $8,000 on the $2.519 million in Oregon sales. So all kinds of assumptions and simplifying assumptions and putting this together, but it's trying to walk through those steps.
Chris, is there anything to suggest somebody does better or worse under what you have there? What type of industry or size?
It would depend on the how many stages. So all of this are, I mean, every stage here, part of it is in Oregon and part of it's exported. If more of that activity stays in Oregon from stage one through stage seven or however many steps, then the pyramiding could be greater. And so it depends on the structure of the businesses. And this is where sometimes you'll hear one of the criticism is an incentive to vertically integrate. Becomes then a sale from business one to business two actually becomes all within the single business.
We had some testimony from the coalition that just presented that there exists pyramiding in states with sales taxes. To what extent have you seen those studies, or is that consistent with what you've seen?
That is consistent, and it could be added to this kind of this example, where if you see in each stage where I've added that cat or bat tax to the inputs of the next stage, that's where that sales tax would be added. In a similar kind of fashion.
Senator Burdick?
On the flyover companies, as I understand it right now, they pay no tax, correct?
Correct, by assumption. They don't have nexus. We're talking about the C corporations. Yeah.
Right. So do we have a way of figuring out how many of those there are and what the impact of that particular category would be in terms of producing new revenue?
Senator Burdick, it's a good question. There actually is a bill to modify the current corporate tax to try and get at them, and it's related to the minimum tax being a gross receipts tax. So I'm afraid I don't have a good answer at this point. It is something we're looking at, but because they're selling into the state and we don't know about them, they're not on our radar screen, so to speak. So there might be some way to back into some estimates, but you may recall how some those estimates can be not the best.
Yes, we've heard of those. Thank you.
Garbage in. Other questions? Rep. Smith Warner? Okay. Rep. Nathanson?
Okay.
Okay. Next.
Then the last piece I have is on the next page. A question came up. I've been keeping track of the questions, and I'm trying to gradually put together answers. And this was one from. I think it was Tuesday, I was sharing 2014 numbers that we had used in 2017 around gross receipts within the state and across business types. And the question came up about the distribution for the size of the businesses. So the total number of businesses here from the 2014 data we were working with was about 428,000. And you can see that about 82% of them, or about 350,000 of them, have Oregon sales of less than $150,000. And this is really driven by the sole proprietors. Of that 430,000 so business, 275,000 of them are the sole proprietors. And the vast majority of those have sales of less than $100,000. And so when we look at these demarcations of some of the policies that have been talked about over the past couple of years, about 11% have sales of between $150,000 and $1 million. And then 4% have between $1 million and $3 million, and then 3% have $1 million. And so it really shows that for the vast majority of the sales in the state, there's a relatively small number of businesses, a small number of big businesses making a lot of sales. And these are numbers from 2014, and we are working on updating them to more recent data for work this committee is doing.
Thank you.
But whether it's a VAT tax or a gross receipts tax style, if the threshold is $1 million before you start, that will apply to only 7% of Oregon businesses. Everybody else is out.
Probably, well, definitely if talking about receipts tax, because that's the base of the tax. Yeah. If you talk about a VAT or the way the committee has talked about it, it changes a little bit. So we may, depending on the bones, as you indicated, the demarcation may be not $1 million of gross receipts. It may be $500,000 of value added, for example.
Questions on this graphic? Rep. Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chris, maybe this is the next slide, but I try not to ring my computer so that I stay focused on your slides. Is there a one where you translate now this to the amount of business taxes paid by these same under, like, current? So you translate this. Now we've kind of seen the numeric, how many of each kind, then the amount of taxes paid by each?
I wasn't quite ready with that one. It's a matter of going back and also trying to, at some point, just jumping from this 2014 data to the updated 2016 data. So yeah, that's on the list to get to. But I this was my last slide for tonight.
Okay. Thanks. See you tonight. Don't have my
computer. Well, thank you. It clears out our agenda for tonight. We'll be back Monday and Tuesday and start drilling into setting down rates and maybe picking one. Okay, Rep. Smith, are you okay with that?
That is wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks again to the Coalition for Common Good for coming forward, and we also will hear from the Revenue Roundtable next week. Okay, thank you. We are adjourned.